Good evening, and welcome to Terror School. Your usual instructor, Mr. Muller, could not be here tonight. Unfortunately, he was trying to blow up a car and burned his lips on the exhaust pipe. Normally, I would introduce myself, but in order to be able to pronounce my name, you would have to be able to swallow your own foot. So you can just call me Dude. Now, I would like to congratulate the survivors of the take-home test on poisoning. Congratulations. Thank you all for being here tonight. And now for our first lesson, terrorism on a shoestring.
Ba-boom, ba-boom, boom! Ba-boom, ba-boom, boom!
Life can be extreme, though you've ambitions to be dead extremist kooks. And if you haven't any money for some nukes, here's a little scheme to start.
Shoe-bomb, shoe-bomb, shoe-bomb.
Join Al-Qaeda's team. The folks will think that you're a suicidal freak. Just stuff your Nike sneakers with a light plastic. Boost your self-esteem, sweetheart.
Suicide.
Though it has a sulfur sting, though this bomb is crude, no one will suspect a thing. It smells like airline food. Soon you'll live a dream with 40 virgins who will meet you and you'll see. The only problem is the virgins look like me. That should make you scream, sweetheart. Shoe-bomb.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're listening to us in the Sacramento area, you can hear this program on 96.5 FM. Coming up next, the foundations of modern terrorism. Martin Miller talks to Peter Schlein about the foundations of modern terrorism. He starts with the French Revolution.
Duke University history professor Martin Miller is the author of this book, The Foundations of Modern Terror, State, Society, and the Dynamics of Political Violence. Professor Miller, is there a working definition of modern terrorism?
Well, what I have tried to do is to formulate one, which is a perilous path because so many others have tried. There's a book-length monograph on just that, definitions. So I think that the clearest way to understand what I've tried to do is to refer back to what, in fact, are two kinds of perspectives. One is the idea that governments, and especially dictators, exercise terror against their own citizens, the Hitlers, the Stalins, the Pol Pots of the world. And the other is the world of post 9/11 that we're most familiar with, which is the insurgencies from below, who seem to pose, and so we're told, and sometimes we realize how serious the threat is, that they are, in fact, a danger to us. So what I've tried to do in this book, in defining terrorism, is to bring together those two strands, to understand that it's an interactive process between governments and their security agencies on the one hand, and insurgencies with their international networks on the other. It's the interactive process that has fascinated me.
And I want to read two statements from the introduction to your book and have you explain those a little further. Perhaps because those in power are inherently suspicious of claims challenging the legitimacy of their authority, and because those who are without political power covet it so desperately, all the parties involved in the violence are vulnerable to exaggerating their roles. And terrorism is a way of seeing the world, of understanding, or in many cases misunderstanding, the dominant political paradigm of the particular historical moment.
Right. Yeah, you've picked out some pregnant passages. I think on the one hand, what we're talking about here is the question of accepting the legitimacies of governments. We talk about failed states. We talk about varieties of kinds of governments, dictatorships, authoritarian governments, democratic governments. But what I'm interested in is, and maybe this might be a way of explaining it, this is a 200-year-old story, even more than that. Since the time of the French Revolution, in brief, we have faced a situation in which we don't really know what legitimate government is anymore. There was a time before the French Revolution when monarchies ruled the world, and it was all very clear and monolithic and largely unquestioned. Everyone has now an assumption of right with regard to deciding what politics ought to be dominant and which politics ought to be seen as threatening and dangerous. That means that your opinion, my opinion, are as valid as the people who in fact are in power. So there is that treacherous path of understanding how it is that governments who seem so strong and so convinced of their authority really aren't. That's one side. The other side is that, yes, people who feel that their views are not being paid attention to, who feel that they have an answer that's more right than and more valid and will create a more just world than the government in power at the moment, takes upon itself to use various tactics to bring that change about. When all else fails, violence comes into play, and then we have situations of terrorism. So it's a very long, enduring involvement between two sides. And it is, yes, a way of seeing the world, because once you, I like to call it, go underground, that is to say, once you leave the conventional world that you and I live in and participate, let's say, if you're talking about insurgencies, joining one or another of those movements, you have removed yourself from the legal and moral codes that most of us live with. The same thing happens to be true in governments. It's a world of utter secrecy. We are protected by those governments, and they have knowledge that we are not supposed to have, because by having it, we are endangering national security. This is the way we are to understand it. What's fascinating to me is when these two worlds interact with each other, when they provoke each other, when they become agents within the organizational structure of the opposite side and adopt their habits. So that's part of the way of seeing the world. When you're in a clandestine situation, it's very difficult to understand, and you can't go back once you're there, to understand the world that you've left behind.
What's one of the examples of the interaction between governments and terrorists that you speak of?
There are many, but I think one or two of the most emblematic take me back to Russia. And in the book, as I'm sure you know, I have a vast canvas that I look at Western Europe, Russia, and Latin America and other countries as well. One of the best examples is the situation that takes place in Russia. There was, and I'll give you just one example, which is admittedly is not the most common, but it's an exaggerated example of what goes on all the time. A person who is hired by the security agency of the government to become a mole in an insurgent organization. Let me try not to mention names because it'll simply be confusing, but you'll be familiar with the type. So this person then is on the payroll of the government. He goes underground, joins a revolutionary organization, an insurgency. That's, in fact, a very violent group that's seeking to overthrow that very government. One day, and this is what I think best response I can think of to your question, one day that person is charged with the action, tactic, of essentially assassinating his boss in the government, who is, let's say, the prime minister, which happened at least on two occasions that I know about in the period of Imperial Russia before the revolution of 1917. And so the person then has a choice. Does he blow his cover? Or does he, in fact, carry out the assignment with all the perils involved? In the two cases that I know about, and they're documented in my book, in each of those cases, they decided not to blow their cover. And they ended up killing their boss, the prime minister. So the interactive process at that point was so intense that they were imitating each other. Their documents, the documents that were produced at the time by both the government and the insurgents, are almost replicas of one another because they're fascinated by the other side at the same time that they're trying to take them out.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Platoon must swell with pride for the nation's youth, the cream of which is marching at his side, for the fascinating rules and regulations that we share, and the quaint and curious costumes that we're called upon to wear. Now Al joined up to do his part, defending you and me. He wants to fight and bleed and kill and die for liberty. With the hell of war, he's come to grips, policing up the filter tips. It makes a fella proud to be a soldier. When Pete was only in the seventh grade, he stabbed a cop. He's real RA material, and he was glad to swap his switchblade and his old zip gun for a bayonet and a new M1. It makes a fella proud to be a soldier. After Johnny got through basic training, he was a soldier through and through when he was done. Its effects were so well rooted that the next day he saluted a good humor man, an usher, and a nun. Now, Fred's an intellectual, brings a book to every meal. He likes the deep philosophers, like Norman Vincent Peale. He thinks the army's just the thing because he finds it broadening. It makes a fella proud to be a soldier. Now, Ed flunked out of second grade and never finished school. He doesn't know a shelter half from an entrenching tool, but he's going to be a big success. He heads his class at OCS. It makes a fella proud to be a soldier. Our old mess sergeant's taste buds have been shot off in the war, but his savory collations add to our esprit de corps. To think of all the marvelous ways they're using plastics nowadays, it makes a fella proud to be a soldier. Our lieutenant is the up-and-coming type. Played with soldiers as a boy, you just can bet. It is written in the stars, he will get his captain's bars, but he hasn't got enough box tops yet. Our captain has a handicap to cope with, sad to tell. He's from Georgia, and he doesn't speak the language very well. He used to be, so rumor has, the dean of men at Alcatraz. It makes a fella proud to be what as a kid I vowed to be. What a luck to be allowed to be a soldier at ease.
And now, back to the foundations of modern terrorism.
Did 9/11 change our understanding of how terrorism acts?
Huge. Huge. One of the things I tell my students all the time is, please read the Patriot Act. I rarely meet anyone who has actually read it. It's a document that explains so much of the passion and heat of the post 9/11 world. When I try and introduce this theme to my students, which I'm doing now that this book is out, I've been using it for the first time in my class. One of my students, I think, made a wonderful comment. She said, "We are the children of 9/11. How can we possibly understand that our government might be involved in the very things that we're calling terrorism?" That said so much to me somehow, how difficult the gap was from where I'm coming from, which is an experience that goes back from the 1960s and 70s, years spent doing research in the Soviet Union, to the passion of understanding that the Islamic world is now what the communists and the anarchists and other enemies of the state have always been.
Back to the 60s, in the U.S., the Weather Underground, the Black Panthers, were those terrorist groups?
They were, but the terrorism of the situation involves an understanding of exactly what I'm talking about, the fact that the FBI and the CIA were deeply involved in sending their own agents into these organizations. And in some cases, and I have evidence for this as well in the book, I don't think it's any secret anymore, these documents are public, of actually provoking, in some cases, acts of violence. Because the insurgent organization, this has certainly was true of the Black Panthers many times, they weren't doing what they were supposed to do in terms of violence at that particular moment. So the government agent who's actually surveilling them from within provokes the situation, takes it upon him or herself to create the violent act. That'll allow then the forces of law and order to make the arrests that they want to do anyway. So that happened over and over again.
Was 9/11 a political act?
9/11's a complicated story, and for historians, it's still something that we don't fully understand and can't yet until we have all the two Ds, as I tell my students, the distance and the documents that we need to fully understand it. 9/11 was an act of a political transition, I think might be the best way to understand it. There were a number of acts that led up to it. It was, or it seems to be at this point, a kind of a climactic moment in that evolution, which goes way, way back to a number of different streams, and I'll just mention one of them, and that is the 1953 CIA-sponsored overthrow of the Mossadegh government in Tehran, in the capital of Iran. Again, this is perfectly public information. The Iranians never forgot about that. The seizure of our embassy in 1979 was one of the consequences. Our support of the Shah turns into the Ayatollah. So all of that, and there are many, many streams like that, that one has to, I think, put together to understand 9/11 in the political manner that you ask about, yes.
Professor Miller, would you define the 1953 overthrow of Mossadegh in Iraq as a terrorist act, a state-sponsored terrorist act?
Yes, I would, indeed. I have trouble with state-sponsored also, I might add, because finding the difference between what a state sponsors and what a state actually does is a fine line in some cases. There are instances where it's quite clear. We always use the term with regard to Libya for years. But in terms of the operation here, the British and the Americans were directly involved in a long campaign. By the way, this might be a footnote to your question. I found out, and again, I'm not revealing any secrets here, that the Ayatollah Khomeini was on the payroll of the CIA at the time in 1953. He was a young theological student who was only too happy to support the demonstrations that led to the overthrow of the Mossadegh government.
Why?
That's what you get involved with.
Why?
Why did he?
Yeah, why was he involved in that?
I don't know that there's any evidence on his motives. He may have wanted the money because all these people were paid to demonstrate. The CIA and the British MI5 really organized these demonstrations.
Then go back to what you said before. Why do you have trouble with the term state-sponsored?
I have trouble with that because it seems to distance the government from actions that, in fact, it is responsible for. It seems as though that the government, by sponsoring it, is not actually doing it. That's all I really mean by that. For instance, the question of, let's take rendition, which is a post 9/11 and a Patriot Act condition that allows us to, as I'm sure you know, send captured insurgents to places to be tortured for information because we're not allowed to do it in this country. Now, I think that's part of the situation of terrorism. To me, it's not sponsored, it's direct involvement. So that's all I meant, was to make that distinction.
Do you consider the Patriot Act a terrorist act?
No. It's not. It's a legislative act. It's an amazing act because, among other things, it was passed by 99-1. If my recollection is correct, only Bernie Sanders of Vermont voted against it, and there's never been a vote like that in the Senate in my lifetime. It's not a terrorist act, but it provides an atmosphere in which governments can involve themselves in the very activities that I'm talking about legally. And by the way, legal terrorism is something that exists in many governmental situations in different registers. It's important not to assume that they're all the same because they're not.
Over the course of the U.S. history, has there been so-called legal terroristic acts
by
the government?
Yeah, I think that one of the best examples, and I devoted quite a bit of space to it in one of the chapters of the book, is the whole story of slavery in this country, loosely referred to as Jim Crow laws. They were laws, part of a judicial system that was ratified all the way up to the Supreme Court in many cases, which permitted not only segregation, but also violent acts of lynching in public demonstrations, which were reported, by the way, in the newspaper the next day. All this I found extraordinarily shocking when I first came upon all of that evidence. I don't know another country that had that long-standing an involvement with political violence. And it was political all the way through, precisely because it was involved with the denial of voting rights and because of the judiciary, which protected those acts of lynching. By the way, just a quick aside, because it's again partly so stunning, there was a collection of postcards that was discovered by a guy from Indiana who was driving around collecting these things about 15 or 20 years ago, which... it's called Without Sanctuary. That's the website where one can find all of this. These postcards were sent by people who were at the lynchings back to their relatives as though they had missed a great event and described what they had seen. In some cases, scotch-taped fingernails, hair singed with fire from the lynchings onto these postcards. And on the other side was a photograph of the African-American person who was usually hanging from a tree with crowds surrounding, smiling, picnic baskets. Horrible stuff.
Given what you just said, can you then justify any reaction to that, what you called political terrorism of the Jim Crow era?
Reaction in what sense?
From African Americans.
Well, I have some problem, I guess, with the term justifying. If a wrong is done to you, in part it's human nature to try to rectify it in some way or other. We do this every day in small ways. But I think this is such a massive environment of outrageous behavior. Or at least so it seems to me now, in retrospect. It certainly wasn't seen by people at the time that way, and I understand that. It's to me understandable that violent actions provoke violent reactions. If that's your question, I understand it. I certainly don't justify it, but I do understand it.
Thank you. We'd like to do something for you now. We haven't heard a girl sing it, and since it's so popular, we'd like to try and do it for you. Hope we remember all the words. Oh, the shark has pearly teeth, dear, and he shows them pearly. disappeared out of sight. Oh, the shark bites with his teeth, dear. Scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, where's McHeath, dear? So there's not a trace of red.
a purple mountain majesties. Over the fruited plain. But now wait a minute, I'm talking about America, sweet America. You know, God done shed his grace on thee. He crowned our good. Yes, he did. Heavy brotherhood from sea to shining sea. You know, I wish I had somebody to help me sing this.
Now for something completely different.